All right, it's the DT difference. It's 30 years experience in the game, DT Systems. E-collars we've been using for a while now, but let's quickly talk about their dummy launchers. They got the Super Pro dummy launcher and the remote dummy launcher. It's a great way for you and your dog to get ready for duck season. Loud bangs, make sure your dog's cool with gunfire before you use it. But I want you to add it to your repertoire, bag of tricks, and get you and your dog ready for duck season. It's the Super Pro Dummy Launcher by DT. Hashtag man's best kennel. It's Gunner Kennels, baby. It's a kit. We had Addison on the podcast, a phenomenal dude, always innovating our industry. And one of the things that he brought up is it's a kit. It's not just the kennel itself. You've got the fan 2.0 for your summer, right? Like it's hot out. We got to keep that dog cool. In wintertime, you got the all weather kit. Keeps that core body temperature in there so the dog doesn't have to work as hard to stay warm. They also have the magnetic door accessory that keeps that body temperature in there. And then the straps. Everybody thinks like, oh, I'll just go to Home Depot and get the cheapo straps. Well, listen, they developed these straps so that basically you can lift a VW bug with the two straps. So if you were to get in a car accident on the way to the duck blind or the training grounds, that dog is going to be beyond strapped and stay safe. Check it out. Gunner Kennels, baby. Slide into the DMs. We'll hook you up. All right. Our number one asked question is revolving around force fetch. Whether your dog drops the bumper or duck at the edge of the water, or you failed a few hunt tests because the dog monkeys with the birds or won't pick up a bird, let me help you help your dog. Bunch of different breeds, bunch of different personalities, start to finish, teaching you how to do it. Links in the description. What's going on, and welcome to another episode of Lone Ducks Gun Dog Chronicles, baby. We've got a really fun episode coming at you with Carlos Ramirez, a premier canine protection decoy trainer, handler, tons of life experience. Really fun to talk to him. We talked about classic and operant conditioning, which, let's be honest, I'm not a scientist or a dictionary. So he did an awesome job describing those things. We talked about drive capping and how to manage really high drive Labradors and personal protection dogs, and just heard his background story of how he got started in the game and how he came over here to the US and all some really cool stuff. So really enjoyed talking with him. Really charismatic guest. Loved it. But first, do me a favor. If you enjoy this episode, if you enjoy Instagram, if you enjoy YouTube, you will definitely enjoy Patreon. Patreon.com/LoneDuckOutfitters. Click the link in the description and join that community, just like buying me and Kevin a beer. Next up, the Force Fetch course. Man, I get it's the most asked question on Instagram is, not sure if I want to force fetch my dog. Should I force fetch my dog? I've never done it. Da, 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 da. We built start to finish a course for any dog, any breed, any personality, too soft, not too hard, da, 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 da. It'll fit the bill. And we walk you through it step by step by step so that you can do it. That link will be in the bio or in the description as well. So if you're interested, click that bad boy, join the Force Fetch course, join the Patreon, and let me help you with your dog. And then next up, from the duck blind to the holding blind, baby, it's Purina. It's the food that fuels the truck of Lone Duck. Adult dogs are on 30-20. Young dogs are on the large breed puppy formula. So check them out. Feed the dog the best. They give you their all. You give them your all, baby. Next up, man's best kennel, the Gunner Kennel. Made in America, quality stuff, hands down. They are constantly innovating products that help us keep our dogs safe. And 2023, we're excited to do more with them. We're going to talk a lot more with them on the podcast too. So stay tuned for 2023. Next up, Dogtra e-collars. The collar that's in my hand, on their neck, in my back pocket, on my truck, in my truck. Let's go, Dogtra e-collars. Great present for Christmas, birthday. You know, get a new puppy, get your hubby or your girlfriend the Dogtra Kyler. Next up, shoot or shoot, baby. Bismuth. I've been slinging that bismuth downrange all duck season. Literally only in Texas did it not connect. And I disappointed myself with the... I don't think it was the bismuth's fault. I think it was mine out in Texas. But everywhere else, I've been having fun shooting it. The Browning Satori shoots it well. So check them out on Instagram. It's Kent Cartridge. Next up, smoke them if you got them, baby. The Traeger Grills. I got a venison backstrap from old Nubby that I got here on the property this season. And I am going to sear it in my cast iron with a little bacon grease. And then I'm going to throw it on the Traeger for a few minutes to just internalize it, get a little smoke flavor. And that's what I'm going to eat for dinner before our Patreon Christmas party, baby. So I'm excited. Next up, Standing Stone Kennels, Standing Stone Supply. Our friends Kat and Ethan are the best, man. They have helped Kevin and I with our YouTube channel. They've helped Kevin and I with our Instagram. They've helped Kevin and I with this podcast. Just really, really good friends of ours. And they've built a company called Standing Stone Supply that gives you any, really anything you need for your dog, from collars to leashes to bumpers to e-collars to, you know, bird traps for flinging pigeons. You name it, they've got it at standingstonesupply.com. Do me a favor. If you're looking for something for your gun dog, check them out first. And lastly, Waypoint Outdoor Collective. They keep us in tune with you and you in tune with us. Let's get in the show. Carlos, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time out of your day. Do me a favor, tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, man. I'm just a Puerto Rican guy that loves dogs, you know. And so I started, actually, I got to come to the Ohio State University. That's how I ended up in the United States. I got a scholarship and I used to play volleyball. I used to play men's volleyball, like, here in the States, it's a woman's sport. But in the Caribbean, in South America and Europe, it's huge, man. Like, it's big. So since I was like 12 years old, I got to travel the world. I played in Spain, in Japan. I got to play everywhere. And a lot of times it was getting paid very well, like 80 grand for 6 months of playing. And I was 13 years old, 14 years old, you know. Dang. So, and I got to send all that money. Yeah, I got to send all that money home. Plus, I got to play for free. I got to travel for free. I got to have fun with my friends, you know? So I didn't know, but I was living life like pretty damn cool back then. Yeah. And I was in Thailand doing the world championships when I was like 17. And then Ohio State happened to meet me there and they offered a scholarship. And I was like, well, I had to choose between going pro and then going to school. And then when Ohio State really approached me, it was a great opportunity to be able to go to school and still play, right? So I did that. But after going to Ohio, man, I was there for 1 year. And I was like, nope, not for me, not this weather. So then I ended up in San Diego, and I just kept doing different things. And I never really could pinpoint what I liked, what I wanted to do. So I was in San Diego doing construction, and I was doing extremely well. I went to culinary school, doing extremely well as well. And it was all... always playing volleyball in the background, but just wanted to do something different. I've been doing it since I'm like 12 years old, you know, and I was kind of fed up with it. And then my family has Pasofino horses in Puerto Rico. And I was one like summer, I think I was back home, just hanging out, being home. And my grandma told me, you're not very good at training horses. Maybe you should train dogs or something. Just kind of joking, like straight up just making fun of me because I wasn't good with the horses. And I was like, well, I'm going to look into it. And next thing, you know, one thing led to the other. And I went to the Tom Rowe School. And then after that, it just kept going, man. I just started working more with law enforcement and military working dogs. And then it really took off. It really, really took off from there.
What year was that?
It was like 2010, 2011, around there. Okay. When it all started, really. Yeah. It's that's like about 10, 11 years ago.
About the same time for me as well, when I made the leap. Yeah, full time.
Yeah.
That's cool. So did you move back to the U.S. and you said Tom Rose?
Yeah, I went to the Tom Rose School that is in Missouri. Yeah.
What is that like there?
Man, it was a great experience for me because I didn't know anything about the dogs. I didn't have an in the dog world. I didn't know anyone. And I think it was back then the social media stuff wasn't that big. Like being a popular dog trainer in social media, that was not a thing.
No.
That kind of started with us, you know? And so I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anything. So it was great to be able to go to a place and get that flood of information. I was there like 10 months, I think. And I'll be honest, when I left, I knew a ton. But nowadays, if I was to do it all over again, I would just find a trainer, an apprentice mm-hmm. under them, 100%. Because I would have gotten the same and I wouldn't have to pay as much as I did. It was pretty expensive. It was like 30 grand after everything was said and done, you know?
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
For me, coming from Puerto Rico, that was a lot.
It's a lot for me, buddy.
So, yeah, it still is a lot, exactly. So it was a lot of money at once, but it was definitely worth it, you know? Like, I put a lot into it. The last, like, month in Missouri, I had to sleep in my car because they pretty much kicked me out of the dorms. Like, hey, we have a new class coming, man. You have to hurry up and graduate. And yeah. I was like, I'm not leaving. I'm not quitting. I'm not going to live until I'm done. So I spent like a winter in Missouri in the back of my truck, man, with three dogs. Just me and three dogs, yeah.
What kind of dogs did you have back then?
I had a Border Collie. I had a Malinois. And I had an English Bull Terrier that I brought with me to the school. It was just my pet.
Yeah.
And I lived in the back of the truck. It was like, I remember one day, it was like 10 degrees outside. And I was freezing. It was so bad. And I called my dad and I was like, Dad, it's like 10 degrees outside. And I got to be honest, I'm sleeping in the truck. Like, I'm thinking he's going to be chucked. And he's like, don't worry, I'll help you. Like 2 days later, shows up a Sub-Zero sleeping bag mail.
That's cool.
His help. He was like, you got to go through it. Like, there's nothing else. You have to go through it. Just get it done. If you want to hurry up, that call should inspire you to leave, you know? And he was right. I was like, all right, this got to stop. And I really started working on my dogs, and I was able to finish and graduate.
Good for you. What was the course like in like a couple minute breakdown of what you got to experience there?
So basically you get to first, they teach you all the basics of like kind of how dog training works, a little bit of the psychology part behind it, not much. It was more learning hands-on. And then you start with a puppy. They require you bring like 5-week-old puppies. You need two of them to graduate. And then in the next like 4 months, 5 months, you end up doing think of the AKC obedient competitions, like the open, the utility, you know, all those steps. Those are your testing.
Okay.
So they teach you how to teach your dog, and then you have your puppy goes out there and does it. If he does it, he gets scored. If he doesn't, then you don't pass. So it's not you passing tests, it's your dog, which is the best part, right? And that's why there was like 25 people when I started in the class, and we only like 6 of us graduated. Or 8 of us, because everybody else just quits. It's super hard when you don't know anything to take a puppy to that level. And more when you don't know anything.
Sure.
So it was really hard, and it took a lot of work. And just like everything, you know, in dog training, if you don't put in your work every day, it's going to show. It's super obvious.
Yeah.
So that's something that it was very difficult for a lot of people to be able to get through all that discipline, one thing after the other, you know? So, but yeah, we go through it. You do tracking, a lot of chits and stuff in the protection side. We did a lot of some of the bird training as well, the retrieves, directionals. We have to do all of those. And then after that, if you're probably when they graduate, you're done. If you get chosen, then there's a master's program that is like a second level program. And I was able to get into that and I finished that as well. And it's basically just asking more of the dogs. So if you finish in the basic level of AKC for the professionals course, for the masters, you have to take it all the way to a utility level, you know, to a utility and stuff like that. So it just got harder and harder, basically.
Very cool. What made you transition from like the obedience side to protection sports and the protection side?
Man, it just is a bug, man. It's literally you get bitten by that bug and it's hard to shake it off. I remember being in Missouri up there at the school and watching a guy named Jake Kemp. He's a PSA decoy. And watching Jake with this dog coming at him like 40 miles an hour, you know, 35 miles an hour, hitting him full speed. And he catching the dog and putting the heat onto this dog. And the dog lets go when he's told. And he's standing there looking at him wide open, wagging his tail. Like, let's do that again, you know. And I was like, Dad, I want to do that. Where do you sign up for that part of it, you know? And I'm from Puerto Rico, so I never had the hunting background. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm such an outdoors person. Like, I hunt. I just got back from Idaho. I was steelhead fishing.
Cool.
Yeah, man, I love it being in the outdoors. I got an elk tag for next year for archery. I'm huge with my bow, and it's because we didn't have that in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And for us, like, I think so many Americans don't understand the privilege they have of stepping outdoor and getting your food. I live in a legit island where you can't hunt anything other than iguanas, bro. And like, let me tell you something, that is a huge, if there was so many people that will be living a little bit better if we could go catch our own food.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be eating mac and cheese from a can every day, you know, and stuff like that. They will be hunting, I bet you that. But we don't
Yeah.
get that privilege. So here, the people that don't take advantage of it, I just don't understand, because it's such a blessing to have a country like this, that you have the resources to go out there and just catch food, man. Like, so I'm
Yeah.
huge into it. That's something that I love, but I never had that growing up. So I didn't have the whole using the dog to go hunt with you, right? I had the dog protecting the house thing. That's all we
Okay.
had.
Yeah.
You know, we had Rottweilers, we have pit bulls, the very stereotypical Hispanic dogs, huge dogs in the house that said, "Do not come in here.
Right.
Next house," right? That's what we cared. That the dogs told the guy, "Wrong house, buddy. Look next. You know, look to the next door, not this one." That's
Sure.
all we care that the dogs did. So when I was able to see all these other things that people are doing with dogs, it was like pretty amazing, you know. And that's one of my biggest, what you guys do is, it's funny because we have a joke in the law enforcement side that we all start thinking we're the super cool things, and we all end up asking for your guys' help with our hunting dogs
It's
because it's
real.
the only place.
I feel the same way about you guys.
Yeah.
It's like
Yeah.
I went to the Canine Street League and they're all asking me questions. I'm like, dude,
Yeah.
that's no big deal.
Yeah.
Like you
Yeah.
getting them to do that is wild.
Yeah.
And so it's just like this
Yeah.
fun back and forth.
Yeah. And I think
Yeah.
it comes because a lot of what we do is genetic,
Right.
right? Like, the dogs are doing it. Like, that's the part. Like, the strongest dog that I work with, like, if I'm working with like tier one special forces dudes that were working with very serious stuff, the dogs are doing most of it, like, genetically doing it. We're just literally, it's like saying a border collie is herding a pack of whatever, right? Like cows or whatever, a herd of cows. And the trainer goes like, "Yeah, I did that." "No, you didn't. You selected the right one and then just let him do it a little more, but he had it, right? Now grab a golden retriever off the pound and then do that. Then I'll say you're a good dog trainer, right?"
Yeah, it's a good point.
So, but we're starting with dogs that are running automatic, man. That's why, like, people see me now and the stuff that I can train my dogs to do now, and they're like, "You're amazing." And I'm like, "Not now. Now I'm actually a worse trainer than when I started. Now I have the best genetics in the country.
Right.
This is like a Tesla driving itself. I don't have
Right.
to do anything. When I started 11 years ago, I had the leftovers, and what I did with those dogs, that was really dog training, right? The dogs
Yeah.
we have now, man, they're so good. The genetics I have access to now is just, they train themselves. They do everything.
That's a super valid point that I had a discussion with my assistant trainer about is like I still will train any dog, right? But I have been blessed to start getting better quality dogs, better genetics, better raising of the puppies, and so they get to me at a higher level. Just up here in the brain, where she may get the dog that, I don't need to train, she needs to train. And so the quirks, the weird behaviors, the issues that we've got to deal with is going to make her better in the long run for sure.
That's called, I call it the unexpected, right? Is the one thing you don't have something in your tool bag for that you're like, "Whoa, wait, I didn't see that before,"
That's
right? It's
right.
the unexpected that gets you. But that's what makes you a good dog trainer. That's what made me who I am. It's that when I came down here to Florida after school, I was like, "Hey, I want to be a decoy. I want to train all these aggression dogs." And everybody that had good dogs were like, "Who are you again? Like, you're not gonna work my dog. No, you're not gonna touch my dog." But then there was somebody else that told me, like, "Hey, that decoy fired me because my dog is not good enough. He said my dog doesn't have what it takes, but I want to do bite work." And I was like, "Okay, bring him down. I'll work that dog." And then after like 8 months to a year of working, the dog did bite, right? And it was like, "Oh, well, that worked. I learned
Right.
something new," right?
Yeah.
And then that's what really makes you a good dog trainer, is that.
Absolutely. Yeah, the ones that challenge you to think outside of the box that don't do it like everybody else makes you better.
Bingo.
Absolutely. So you left the Tom Rose School. Correct me if I'm wrong. Did you go and work with, because you've done the tier one, like special forces dogs. How did you get into that funnel?
So that's something that it's literally just happened in the last like 6 months, 8 months that I've been more involved with these guys. I've been out with them a couple of times to the base, you know, and run a couple of trainings with them, like week long trainings that I did just for them. But it really all started when I came down here back to Florida after going to the Tumbrell School. Happens to me, man. And this is what I tell everyone that's like, hey, I want to do exactly what you've done. How do I get there? Luck, just straight up luck, being in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. Sure, I made the most out of the opportunities I was given, but I was given those opportunities because I happened to be the guy that was there. Mm-hmm. There was nothing special about me. You know, it wasn't because, oh, this guy's so good, let's bring him over. No, I was the one that was there. So right in the area where I moved to, there was a person that owned a kennel. Now, this guy is a scumbag, like literally one of the worst people in the community. But I didn't know that back then. He was the only person who owned a kennel. And to this kennel on the weekends came a guy named Wayne Dodge. And mm-hmm. this guy named Wayne Dodge, he would come on the weekends and he owned a construction company, but he was a very good decoy. And people came, brought their dogs over and we did bite work. You know, we did a class on the weekends and I saw him and I was like, I want to learn from him. And somebody told me that guy was the one who trained the dogs for Mike Ritland in the West Coast when they had the Navy SEAL program. And I was like, what? That guy? Like, man, he's a construction worker. And he's like, yep, he's really good. So I apprenticed under him. I kind of got, it's a pretty funny story, but I got whooped in an abandoned strip club. Like they were using it for training. Yeah, they were using it for training. And we went in there just to do bite work one day. And the guy whooped me. Like three guys jumped me. They made me jump where the suit. Dogs were biting me. I was puking. My new girlfriend, who's now my wife, we were dating for like 3 days. And I got beat up. Like I was bleeding from my lip. I had a black eye. I got whooped in front of her. It was, and then after they were done, they're like, okay, you can come back next weekend. And
that was like, oh, like great.
My initiation. I was like, okay, at least something came out of that, you know? So after apprenticing with him for like 2 years, one day, I'm not kidding, I'm sitting in my living room and my phone rings and it's a number from Texas. And sure enough, it was Mike Ritland. He mm-hmm. called me and he's like, hey, I need someone to come over and literally run my facilities. Do you want to do it? And I was like, yes, sir. I was there like 3 days later. I packed everything I had. Got in a car and I left. And I even told my girlfriend, we were dating. I was like, hey, I got this opportunity. I have to go. And she's like, let's go. We packed cool. everything together and she moved with me. And then I was out there with him for like 2 years. And I did everything, all the training, everything with him. And I trained all his dogs. So after that, one day I owe him so much in my career. One day I told him like, hey, boss, I need a raise. You know, me and my wife are getting serious. And he said, no, you need to go open your own business and go on your own. I'm not going to give you any more raises. And I was like, are you serious? Like, come on. And he's like, no, do I need to fire you so you can go on your own? You're like, you need to take a risk, you know? And wow. He legit told me, you either quit or I'll fire you right now. And I was like, all right, I'll quit. And I'll move back to Florida and start my own stuff. And he gave me a recommendation letter. And he told me, here, get a job anywhere you want. And gave me that recommendation later. And I chose to come down and just kind of go on my own first. And what I did was, as soon as I got back, I went to all the local law enforcement departments. And I told them, whatever you guys need, I'll train for free. I'll work your dogs for free. And here where I am in Marin County, Florida, their sheriff's department gets a lot of work with the dogs, man. These guys are, like, you can just go on Facebook and look up Marin County Canine Unit, and you'll see pretty much all of their bites. The sheriff is awesome. He backs the blue. Like, he backs his canine guys like crazy. So all the bites are on Facebook. They get a lot of backup. So I got lucky that I happened to live in one of the most active areas in the U.S. for actual canine bites. Like, these guys are getting 3 and 4 bites a week, and they have, like, 9 dogs. So dang. there's like 30 people getting bit every week in my county. You know,
so hang on. How do they not work dogs then?
It's a sheriff.
If it's that prevalent, I feel like it would be known that, like, just no, they're going to bite you. Stop it.
Oh, no. It's sheer stupidity, man. They bite the same people twice. They'll bite the same person twice. Absolutely. It's just not smart people, right? And something we have here is, everybody runs. I feel like in the inner cities and somewhere else, everybody gives up. Like, I traveled the entire United States doing seminars everywhere in the U.S. I was just in Arizona, in Maricopa County, like 2 weeks ago, a week ago. And everybody gives up. That's what they tell me. They're like, I get there with the dog, and they're like, no, no, please don't bite me. Here in Florida, like, the come Florida man sees a dog, yeah, and they're like, I'm going to outrun him. Like, they just, the Florida man, you know what I mean? And it's something that they get so much work out here that I had a very unique opportunity that everything we tried on the dogs, you know, everything we practiced, we were able to try it the next day.
Wow.
Right. So we try something with the dog. The very next night, the handler will come back and tell me, like, bro, that worked like a charm. Let's nice. Do that again. Or they will tell me, like, nope, that didn't work. Let's not do that again. Someone got bit that shouldn't have gotten bit. You know what I mean? Or something like that. So it's not like the other departments that when they train something, it took them a year before that dog got a bite. And the sure. dog already forgot everything in training. No, we actually practice something tonight. It's getting used tomorrow. Like that yeah. fast. Or even in training. I had guys in the middle of training get a call and jump in the car and go bite someone and come right back to training. And be like, yeah, it worked. I just did it. You know, so like having that crazy opportunity, it like immersed me in the canine world for law enforcement. Like it was putting my feet deep. I got to go on ride alongs. Like I got to see it firsthand. You know, wow. So like these guys were really getting after it. And after that, I started traveling. Like other departments started noticing, like, hey, what are these guys doing? What are they getting so much work? And me and the head trainer for the unit, his name is Jay Nix, Jeremy. We got involved with Canines United, which is a big nonprofit that pays for training. So they travel, you know, we travel across the US and we give free training for departments. So after all of that, we got to travel all across the US and then the name started spreading, right? Like we got a little bit more people to know who we are. And then after that, man, the military one day called me. We did a big symposium in Colorado and I got to meet a bunch of them. They were like, yeah, they liked what we did. Then the following week, we were doing another seminar just for law enforcement. They sent a couple of their guys just to come and watch what we were doing. And then it took off from there. Then we started working with the special forces guys from the Army specifically. We've been working with them. And man, they got their stuff figured out. And that's something that it's very difficult for us because it's very different to work from law enforcement to what those guys do. And let's just leave it at that. They don't carry handcuffs.
Right.
So it completely changes the apprehension because with law enforcement, we train to someone's watching and these guys need to go back in the patrol car and they're going to give an explanation of what's happening. The military just don't do none of that. They have a completely different set of rules. So what we do in training is completely different for them. What we're allowed to do is obviously there's no rules. So it's a completely different set of training that we do for them. So in basics, it's similar, you know, what we're looking at of the dog and stuff like that. But law enforcement has the short end of the stick for sure.
That was going to be my next question for you is, as you have progressed in the dogs, right? Mm-hmm. What have you seen across the board as far as like the police dog? And I don't want to use the word quality versus a different dog, but kind of like we were talking about, my assistant is getting those dogs. I'm getting these dogs. You know, the tier one is getting these dogs. Mm-hmm. Where are they getting them from breeding wise? And how are those dogs being raised to get the most out of them?
Okay. So that's something that it's a lot of people like to put a lot of romanticism into it. Like these dogs are bred. It's a contract they get with a large vendor that imports their dogs from the Europe. Like, that's it. There's no, like, the special forces guys are dictated, like, everything else from the government is a contract, right? Mm-hmm. And there's, like, two or three very large vendors in the U.S. for canines, supplying canines to the military. So they get their dogs from there, period. But those vendors that they get their dogs from, those companies, have very specific selection tools, right? So when they go overseas and they buy 200 dogs, because it's not just the special forces team. Then you also have the military, the MP guys, right? And MP is a completely different tier of dog that they need than what the special forces guys need. So when they're testing through these hundreds and hundreds of dogs, sometimes they come across that one that you're like, ooh, this guy's different. So they set him aside, right? And that's kind of how it goes. They find these very, what we call them unicorns, you know, that are very specific dogs. And then they get set aside for these special forces guys. And then they go and they select from those.
What makes a unicorn in your eyes and their eyes?
It's a dog that sees a grown man and says, I'll take him. No hesitation, no questions asked. They see a grown man and you see the dog and you're like, okay, he has no problem turning me up. And not just because their life is at risk. No, they're doing it for fun.
Right.
They're doing it because it's fun to hurt people, right? And whenever you have, a lot of times that we get the ones that the vendors are like, this dog is a bastard. I can't have him. I'm about to literally put a bullet on his head. So, and we're like, no, we'll take him. He's my guy, you know? And that's actually a very big talking point in the canine world, because that dog that sees a grown man and he's like, I'm not one bit worried about you. I know I can kill you. We have to train him.
And yeah,
we have to teach him. We have to teach him. You have to listen to your handler. It's not always the way you want. You know, there's control. You have to control yourself. And they don't like that. And that's the part where everybody wants a man eater until it's time to live and deal with a man eater. Because what I tell everyone, the handler is also a man, right?
Right.
Or a woman. So it's something you have to keep in mind that you have, that's where progressive training techniques come into play. Right.
Like, so let's talk about those, right? Let's talk about some of the, taking that dog, because that is interesting to me too, is the dog that wants to eat everybody, wants to, you know, take a shot at the title. How are you putting a lead on that dog and saying, hey, buddy, you know, it's time to go to work with me today? You know, is it a one man, one dog thing, or can that dog learn to be passed around and worked with?
No, so the true real dogs are mostly one person type dog, right? And the first thing that you have to do is check your ego at the door. That's the first thing. And it's the hardest thing for most alpha type military guys and law enforcement dudes. Because I say this to all my guys, everybody that's alpha rolling a dog or trying to be dominant over a dog, they put a muscle on the dog first. Nobody's doing it for real. You know what I mean? Right. So you're not proving nothing.
Right.
You're just teaching that dog, while I have equipment on you, you can do nothing to me. But eventually you have to take that equipment off. It's coming off at one point or another. And I have multiple stories of dogs that have literally retired tier one personnel because they were doing obedience with them a little too harshly. They put a muscle on them. And the second the muscle came off, the fight started. Exactly. And then it's on because they're bred and trained for this. So when I have a funny story about that. When I first went to work with Ritalin, we were at the Warrior Dog Foundation. And the Warrior Dog Foundation is literally those dogs that we wanted because they were tier one, the top of the top. They were too much. And even those guys are like, we can't handle him. But they need to go somewhere. So they go to the Warrior Dog Foundation. And then Ritalin told me, those dogs need to be trained. They need to be rehomed in a couple months. So just teach them some basic obedience. And I was like, all right, where's the prong collars? And he laughed. He's like, what? The prong collars. Oh, you're planning on putting a prong collar? Man, let me go get a drink and I'll sit down and watch this. And I'm like, why? And he said, they're not going to let you put a prong collar on them.
Right.
And I'm like, yes, they are. They're dogs. And he's like, oh, buddy, you have so much to learn. And I was like, man, I'm 6'4". I weigh almost 200 pounds. That 70-pound dog is not going to punk me. And he's like, oh, you're about to learn. You're about to learn so much. And I did. I got a couple holes in me. I learned, and then I realized they're really not the bastards that you think they are. They're just being treated unfairly since they were like 10 weeks old, right?
Because they were so hardcore, though. Because they're hardcore, exactly. They're being,
And people think that that's the way to treat a hardcore person. But we don't do that to hardcore individuals. Like, I have multiple Tier 1 Special Forces friends. And I guarantee you, not one of them are we going to be treating around like a punk. Everybody treats them with respect. It's not in a confrontational way. It's just this known fact that that person can hurt you if they choose to, right? So everybody acts very well around them. Mm-hmm. Every dog should be treated like that. Because I'm telling you, right? And I'm talking about including your bird dogs that are not bred to bite people. Because every animal, and I'm telling you, even a cat, can hurt 99% of population on this planet Earth because humans are soft, extremely soft. And these animals are not. Haven't you seen like a stray dog dragging his leg because a car hit him and he's just walking around like knows one business versus we cut our toenails too short and we almost limp for a week, right? So it's something that people lose out of perspective, that you think you're tough because the dog is allowing you to be tough, because he's allowing you to be disrespectful to them. So once you start treating these dogs like you would treat a tier one personnel, then you start seeing a completely different animal. And not just that, the type of dogs you get to train with and work with goes up significantly, because now you can work with dogs that are serious.
So let me ask you a question. How do you go from, okay, I respect you, dog, to putting a leash in and walking that dog? I mean, like, what is that process of integrating a dog into Warrior Dog Foundation that is having, you know, I listen to his podcast and I follow him enough to know that some of these dogs are like almost PTSD and reactive and had too much stimulation, too many live bites, whatever the case may be, that now you get hired to say, okay, let's start teaching him to be a house dog. Like, you might respect the hell out of him, but if he doesn't allow you into his space or want to be trained, how do you work through that?
Yeah, so there's always resources that they need, right? There's resources they want and there's resources they need. And as long as we control those, the dog needs you. And that's how we work, right? So obviously food is they need it. And we control that. That comes from me 100% of the time. So, but it all began with setting expectations, right? There are some dogs that we knew is never going to go into a home that has kids, regardless of how good our training is, right? That one is a one person, maybe there's a wife, might work out, but definitely no kids, right? Versus there's other ones that were like, man, I'll trust that dog with adult kids. If they have teenagers, it will probably work out, right? So we have to set the expectations right from the beginning. But then after that, the process there was very simple. And I'm not joking. The military will pull up to the kennel with a pickup truck and a Roughneck in the back, or just a 700, a plastic 700 in the back. Yeah. They will pull that up to a run, open the crate like this, going over very carefully, open the door. The dog will shoot inside the run, and two military dudes will shut the gate and say, all right, thank you. Get on the truck and leave. Those dogs will be at the gate chewing the fence, just like squeezing the fence, making the holes bigger. And you're like, man, I hope that gate holds on. And then for like 2 or 3 days, I go hand feed them. And like Ritlam feeds a very good like raw food that he feeds the dogs. And they don't want to even eat. They just want to tell you, get away from the kennel. And I'm like, okay, I keep doing that. I go to feed you. You don't want me to feed you. That's fine. Until eventually one day he's licking their lips. And you're like, okay. And you give them food. And then now they associate you with food. And then eventually, the way his kennels are set up, after we've been doing that for like 2 weeks, I just open the run and I let them out, completely let them out loose. Just go run. There's like 20 acres. I don't care where you go. Just take off. And I started hosing, scrubbing the kennels, you know, cleaning like normal. But the dog knew now that every time that I walk by, they got food, you know? So then after I'm done cleaning, I threw a huge block of raw food in there. Boom. And they will go crazy. They will run in there and do it. So, and they get in this routine to the point that I have to lock myself in the run to be able to clean, because they're dying to go back in, because I know there's food coming after we're done. Yeah. So once you have them there, once you can let them out and they can come back into the run, the rest of that is just where the food comes from. Instead of putting it on the floor, I put it in a pouch and I feed them in the field, where I just go for a walk, picking up dog poop with a scoop, you know, and I put my training pouch. And every time the dog approach me, click, food, and I'll walk away. The dog approach me, click, food, and I'll walk away. And after like a week, the dogs are next to you, wagging their tails, begging you, like, please give me some of that food, you know? And then you start training. You start shaping sits, downs, heels. And after you have all of that figured out, it's all classically conditioned, man. We classically condition the behaviors to the point that it's not me. He's doing it. His body's putting that butt on the ground, and he doesn't even know why. Same with the front elbow. They're slamming into the ground, and they're looking at me like, how did I get here? But I don't care. Just give me food. I know it works, right? So we use training and the science that we know to not have to like manhandle these dogs in order to get them what we want. We can free shape all the behaviors we needed. And then with enough repetitions, I put an e-collar on them. And then the e-collar was not me. So you cannot associate it with me like a prong, but I'm literally pulling on the leash. Then they're coming up the leash and then it's all game on. Yeah. No, the collar was just putting a collar. It took me like 3 weeks to put a collar on a dog, right? And then once I have the e-collar on, it's game on, because now everything that the dog already knew, I'm just doing so much of it with a very low tap on the e-collar to the point that it's classically conditioned behavior. He's not even thinking about it. So when I have to up the e-collar and get him at a higher level, it wasn't me, it was just the behavior. Right? It's just a sensation they already understand. So I never associated anything negative coming from me. Anything that a correction, none of that was not me. You know, only the good came from me.
So you just brought it into a part that we said we were going to talk about, classic and operant conditioning. And you also brought in free shaping. So can you maybe, for people who don't know that are tuning in, describe what those things are?
Of course, of course. And this, and I'll start with saying, and this is one of the most argumentative, you know, topics you can get on social media, is classical conditioning and operant conditioning. And it is, because there's so many ways to look at it and to apply it. But this is what I always tell everyone that I'm talking to, right? Is classically conditioned is learning by association. It's just something is so repetitive that you associate, you know, what's happening. And operant conditioning is learning by consequence. Did it work or did it not work for the dog, period? That's what it comes down to. And in classical conditioning, there has to be a very specific order of events for the dog to understand that and associate it, right? So, and that's where people get so confused. Like, no, it's an operant, it's a classical. Listen, it's very easy. Is the cue happening before the act or after the act, right? If it's before the act, it's classical conditioning. If it's after the act, then it's operant, because it's a consequence.
So can you give an example in terms of sit or kennel, like place?
Yep, exactly. Absolutely. So whenever we say sit, right, you say the word sit, it means nothing to a dog. It means absolutely. I can use hamburger. That's why dogs can train in so many different languages, because the sound doesn't matter, right? So the sound happens, and then we need to have a way to make the dog put his butt on the ground. Everybody does that by just raising food. Mm-hmm. You raise food, the dog has to look up, the butt touches the ground. It's very straightforward. It needs to happen in a very specific sequence where I say the word that means absolutely nothing to the dog, followed by the action of putting their butt on the ground, which causes the consequence, right? Which is a reward. They get food or whatever they're going for. When you repeat that enough times, that's very specific sequence, and you say the word sit, the dog is going to beat you to putting their butt on the floor. Because you've done it so many times that he's like, I know what's coming next, right? So, because what I'm trying to condition is the cue, the word sit, that happens before the action, that happens before the dog puts his butt on the ground. That's classical conditioning, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reward, since the dog did what I wanted, I produced something he wanted, right? Food, a toy, whatever. That happened after the fact. That happened after he put his butt on the ground. That's why it's operant conditioning, okay? It's just a consequence of his actions. And that's where a lot of people get a little, sorry, let me stop this here. Okay, there you are. So a lot of people get very argumentative on that, you know, and there's so many ways to see it, but it's because we all learn science in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. Like your school taught it different than my school did. And then we learned this from other dog trainers who are not even teachers at all. And they're telling us like the watered down version of how to do this. Sure. And it's like, well, you learned it from another person, right? And this is a side note, like a joke that I always say. That's why men are so bad at figuring out what women like. It's because we learn from other men.
Right.
It's because, no, but we never ask a woman, right? We always ask other men. Somehow we're figuring out what a woman thinks. But anyway, it's the same. We didn't ask a science teacher to teach us this. It was some other dog trainer guy who all he knows is leashes and e-collars. So, that's where it comes from, right? But that's the way I like to see classical conditioning is this pairing of signals that means nothing to a dog to an action, right? It's something that means nothing to a dog. How can I pair that to an action, right? Like for you guys, you want the dog to go left, you lift your left arm, right? Like lifting your left arm means nothing to a dog. Unless you condition that a million times with something you know he's going to do, like run left. So once you do that, they associate it. But I always like to look at it that way. Classical conditioning is learning by association. Operant conditioning is learning by consequence.
So could it, now that is the consequence a positive consequences like earning a treat, or could it be consequences like you don't sit, I pull up on the lead, butt hits the ground, I relax the lead, and now reward?
It can be either or. It can be, and that's the consequence. It doesn't matter if good or bad, you know. And I feel like that's something that a lot of people in operant conditioning get confused, because the words positive and negative are in there.
Right.
And for us, automatically, and more when it comes to animals, we think good or bad.
Right.
Oh, positive is good, negative is bad. That is not at all what he's talking about. It's like math. It's right. Adding and subtracting. So think yep. about positive and negative on a math context, right? You add something, it's a positive thing. You're adding something, but you can add something bad. Like when I was growing up and I did something wrong, my mom added a flip-flop. She was very good at adding flip-flops. You know what I mean? So she added that to the equation. It was adding sure. that flip-flop, right? So, and it's the same with like punishment. When you lost your cell phone, your parents took away your cell phone to punish something, mm-hmm. right? So it's the same that we're doing. That's all operant conditioning. It's a okay. consequence of your actions, right? So whenever we put those two together, if we put negative and positive as math, that means adding or taking something away. And then the other part is obviously reinforcement or punishment. And those are pretty self-explanatory. Reinforcement makes the behavior happen more often, right? It happens more. Versus punishment makes the behavior decrease the likelihood of it happening. It right. makes the behavior go away. So once you're doing something, think about it from that perspective, the consequences on your dog. Is my dog going to want to do that again or not? Did something was added or not? And we always use the example of the seatbelt. What happens in your car when you get in and you don't put on your seatbelt?
It starts dinging.
Starts dinging, that annoying ding, right? Mm-hmm. But when you do what the car wants, what happens?
Turns it goes off.
Away. Yep. And that ding has trained population to put on the seatbelt better than any traffic infraction ever did.
That's a great point.
Everybody,
man.
Yeah, everybody puts on their seatbelt right now because that, and there's no $20. Nobody's giving you $20 for putting it on. Nobody's throwing Skittles at you. You're doing it because the annoying ding is so bad that the entire population is trained to put on their seatbelt. And so that's how powerful that quadrant is.
Dude, right? That was a phenomenal analogy. Quadrant. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's a very powerful quadrant. It's so powerful that it trained all of us. And yeah. that's something that a lot of people don't understand, and they're doing it constantly. That's our biggest argument with purely positive trainers, that you're not purely positive.
Right.
You're what you're saying sounds good because it makes your feelings feel good. But what you're doing, like I had an argument with a lady not that long ago, and she said, well, you don't know what you're doing. My dog, all he needs is for me, if he doesn't do what I want, he doesn't get a treat. And I was like, so that's negative punishment. And she's like, no, not negative, because he's not hungry. And I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about. You just don't understand what you're talking about, right?
Right.
And I try to educate her. And I'm like, listen, there's specific terminology. Like, if you want to talk in a different context, then I get it. It's good or bad, whatever. But in operant conditioning, if we're talking science, you just literally practice negative punishment. And she's like, but, no, I didn't. And I was like, okay, that's it. Like, I'm not arguing.
Yeah, right. You know? I understand. Well, you also probably aren't going to win many battles with those folks anyways, buddy.
No, there no. isn't.
You no, just
it's not about winning. It's about arguing, right?
That's exactly right. I don't even monkey yeah. with it. I'm no. knock on wood. Nobody bothers me about that stuff.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, I don't have to deal with that. Yeah. One of the things that we do a lot in my training is, and I would like to learn on maybe different techniques, is we do use a lot of compulsion. Right. Mm-hmm. So if I give a command that's been taught and shaped and like we built the foundation and now I want to use the collar to create a speedy, a quicker response to the command. Mm-hmm. So like sending a dog to a pile and then delivering to hand or stopping quick on a whistle and casting. I wouldn't say and casting. I would just say go stop. Those kind of things. I'm creating mm-hmm. compulsion with the collar. The faster you go, the faster it's turned off. The faster you sit, the faster it's turned off. That kind of compulsion, is that ever used in the protection sports or
Absolutely.
In with those dogs? Or because I almost think like when they start feeling that kind of Like you can use a low level or you can get up there. And I do like to teach a dog how to handle higher pressure so that it's not stressful when they get there.
Yeah.
Right. So I'll scale up, scale down.
Yeah. And we do the same. But I think something new that we have been trying, and I don't know if you guys see it in this way as well, we're not using the e-collar as a brake pedal. We're using it as an acceleration method.
Yeah, that's okay, what we, a gas pedal. 100%. Yep.
And because a lot of people see that and they, for example, they hear what you're saying and they will think, well, the dog is probably going faster because he doesn't want the e-collar because it's bothering him. So he wanted to stop. You're using it incorrectly if that's the case.
Correct.
Right? It's something that because of classical conditioning, like we were talking about earlier, I can condition my dog for like a send out, let's say, right? Like yep. We're going to send the dogs. We do that in, actually, there's this very specific dog that the military buys. It's called an SSD. It's a specialized search dog. And it's actually the highest paid dog that you can sell to the military. It's like the most expensive dog the military will buy.
Write that down,
Kevin.
All
it is a bird dog. 100% is nothing else but a bird dog.
Come on,
baby. The dog has to go like 300 yards on a send, sit, look at you, and you send him on directional searches for explosives. That's it. Nothing else. So, and he's the highest paid tier of dogs. I'm not kidding. Look it up. It's called an SSD for the
military. I'll sell them all, baby. I'll sell them all. Yeah.
So, I start with a dog that wants to go out.
Correct.
That wants to run out there, right? So let's say I put a plate with food at the end of the field or something that he's dying to run down there. So now when I know the dog, right before I let him go, I tap the e-collar at a very low level. I start tapping, 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 and then I let them go. Eventually, after I do that enough, he associates that feeling with going as fast as he can downfield, right? Mm-hmm. The thing about the e-collar is that we can graduate it, that we can turn it up and down. So the signal that tells him go fast, I can make that signal tell him go faster.
Yep.
Does that make sense? But at the end of the day, still telling him go, go, go.
That's how we do it. Yep.
Perfect. Perfect. And when we're working with that way, the dogs love the tools.
Mm-hmm.
They like my dogs, I bring out the e-collar and they start wagging their tails. They're like, yes, the fun is about to start, right?
That's right.
And that's always my biggest argument when I tell people that, hey, the training tools, I'm like, listen, you don't understand. My dog loves the e-collar like your dog loves the leash by the door.
That's right.
It's the exact same thing. When I grab it, they go nuts. So it depends on how you use it, right? And how you associate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's, I would say, in essence, that's a very similar way. So we call it force to a pile. Right. So we teach them how to build that compulsion and what it means and how to be successful. And through that success, they become more confident and motivated to turn it off. And then they get rewarded at the end with the bumper. Right.
Of course.
So you build a process to get there. And then, we can send them anywhere we point them to.
Exactly. That's the e-collar also breaks through distractions, right? Like the dog can get distracted with something else. The e-collar will always win. That's distraction. Right. So you can get them back to work. Like, for example, something that we do is when we're tracking for humans, right? Like the dog is following human scent. Well, sometimes, you're running your track. People run by that one tree in the neighborhood that everybody goes to the bathroom in. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I call it like, I have a very good friend of mine, Justin Rigney, that calls that like social media for dogs. That's like a doggy Facebook. Yeah. Everybody goes into that tree, they check in, they pee on it, they see what's happening in the neighborhood. So my police dog is following this like felon that is ready to go to jail. And they're like, oh, look, like Fluffy was here from last week. And they start checking up on the tree. I have conditioned the e-collar that when they feel that e-collar, it means go back to tracking.
That's right.
Go back, find the odor, right? Go back to source. But sometimes the Fluffy that pee on there is in heat or something like that. So it's a very big distraction. Yeah. I have to have a tool that can match that distraction and pass it to tell him get back to work. And then that's where the e-collar comes in. I just turn it up a couple levels and I do it until the dog goes like, oh, get it, go back to work, right? Yeah. And so that's the beauty of it, that we can graduate and match the distraction, whatever it is, the distraction.
What e-collar do you like to use?
So, man, a lot... right now, I'm working a lot with e-collar technologies. Mm-hmm. It's, for me, the most user-friendly, and the technology they're coming out with is pretty popular.
I feel like that brand is very popular in the protection sport world.
Yes. Yeah. And also, I think that a lot of trainers, we like them because when we started and we were broke, the other companies will ask for like $5,000-$6,000 worth of a purchase for you to be a vendor versus e-collar technologies sign you right up and send you a password and you were good to go. Nothing, you know? So if they supported us. So I feel like everybody supports them too.
Very cool. Nice. All right. So let's talk about, you have like a viral video, and then I'll let you go because I know we're getting close to our hour, but you have a viral video that basically you're working on a dog, you're working with a dog, and it's on the table. What are those things called? Mm-hmm. I forget.
Yeah, bike table.
A bike table, right? So the dog is being restrained back. You're presenting the arm, dog bites, and you are trying to promote a good grip, a dog that digs in versus pulls back and all that. So you're working this dog. Can you describe the reasons why and your reaction to the dog in a timely manner to get it rewarded, and then maybe how we can parlay it into a gun dog?
Absolutely. So first of all, we use that table. We call it the bike table, and we use it like a sort of Skinner's box. You guys use that term as well, right? The Skinner's box? Okay. So B.F. Skinner is the father of upper arm conditioning, right? He's the one who started upper arm conditioning and who did all of that. And he had these boxes that he created where he would put a rack inside of it, and he had the levers with the lights and the beep. And when the light came on, that box that he did all his upper arm conditioning experimenting on. So us in dog training, in the canine world, right? We call a Skinner's box to anything we can use to isolate behaviors. Okay. So if, and you guys use it too. I'm sure when you're going to teach a retrieve, you don't start the retrieve in a room full of a bunch of loose dogs.
Right.
You start in a sterile environment, probably on a table, so the dog can't go anywhere, tied up to a leash on the wall or something so he can't move.
Yep.
That's a Skinner's box. It's anywhere where we can restrict and control the behaviors. So when we put a dog in that table, the dog can do nothing but go forward. Because in bite work, there's a lot of bad habits that dog can do, like pulling, right? Imagine that a dog bites someone and they start pulling back. A lot of people think that's good because he's trying to pull the dog, the person into the ground. Or if they're under a car, they can pull them out of the car, right? But what they're not looking at, that a pulling bite causes way more damage.
Right.
It starts tearing flesh. And when we're like law enforcement, they're biting people for real every day. Your department wants to cause, and obviously we want to cause the least amount of damage possible. So right. A full grip that is a full bite, biting full on the all of their teeth, and then they don't move from there. All they do is apply pressure that creates way less damage. So for liability purposes and all of that, it's more efficient to have a full grip. Also, you minimize the chances of somebody getting away from you. If you have a dog that's opening their mouth a lot and changing where they bite, what we call transferring, where they transfer from the bicep to the forearm. Sometimes they bite you in the chest. They go for your face.
Yeah.
When they do all those transferring, it's a chance for me to get away and run away from them. I can take off. I can do whatever, right? So we want a dog that bites with a full grip. Whatever they get, they don't let it go. They just hold on. That's all we want. So we are always trying to promote that in the bite when we're developing dogs. In addition to that, in law enforcement and in protection in general, we use pain compliance, right? That's why when somebody's coming from underneath the car, they're coming out because it hurts so bad that they just comply with what you're saying, okay? Sure. So every time the dog opens their mouth and bites deeper, it causes more pain, right? So whenever we like to teach the dogs, and that's what I was trying to explain on that video, that biting harder and squeezing, and adding more pressure, it's always the answer to turn anything bad that's happening to them to make it go away, to turn it off, okay? So for example, if I grab their paw and they hate it, dogs don't like getting their paws touched, right? So if the dog is in the middle of a bite and I grab their paws and now they're like, damn it, I want this guy to let go of my paw. I try to teach them, bite harder, cause me more pain. And the second you cause me more pain, I let go,
right?
And then that becomes a solution to all their problems. If I'm screaming, telling them to stop, they bite me deeper, I become quiet. If I grab their flank and their skin and I apply a little discomfort and they bite deeper, I let go. So everything I'm doing, if they don't like it or they want it to stop, just bite me harder. And then that will make it go away, right? So we have to go back to somewhere that the dog understands I win. This is something comfortable for me, right? This is something that I'm really good at. I'm sure that for you guys, it's probably the same when the dog finds what he's looking for, right? If you send him 100 yards from you and you tell him search to the left, and all of a sudden they come in contact with that odor and they're like, I'm close. In their brain, that knowing of what's going to happen next is a huge relief of stress.
Yes.
That's why you don't have to go, yes, good job, buddy. He doesn't care about that. The fact that he found it is all the reward he needed.
That's right.
Okay. So as quick as we can get the dogs to that state of mind of, I know what's happening, I'm about to win, that maybe next is the jackpot. That's what happens right before that's when the biggest and dopamine release is. Okay. Biggest dopamine release happens right before the dog gets rewarded. Not after the reward. It's right before. It's the anticipation that, oh, it's coming. It's about to happen.
Right.
Once they get it, actually, it crashes. There's a huge decrease in dopamine after they get it. It's no different than us, right?
So that would be like, if I could equate that to people, it's like my dog's wound like a top until it gets one retrieve under its belt. And then the rest, it starts getting in the groove and starts reacting, you know, better and responds better because it's riding such a high that they get it. And now they can come down and start thinking clearly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what keeps them going. Is that, oh my God, it's happening, right? And it all starts when you put him on the truck. You get up at 4 a.m. to go hunting. They never get up that early. Then they go straight in the truck, and then they put the vest on, and then they see you with the gun case, right? And all those cues start telling them, ooh, buddy, it's coming.
Yep.
It's happening, right? And that dopamine starts building and building and building, and then you get them out of the car and go in the blind. They're like, I knew it. This is happening. That is right there what they want.
Sure.
That's what they're riding. Yeah. Think about people in the casinos, right? Gamblers, they don't, when they win, actually they get depressed because they're not there to win, they're there to play. People who are addicted to gambling, which is what we're trying to do with our dogs, we're trying to make them addicted to work like gamblers. Whenever a gambler wins $1 million, they're just gonna go spend $1.5 million because they did not go there for the money, they went there for the ding 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 ding, right? And for you guys and for us, it's that clicker. It's that gunshot going off. That's that ding, 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 right? So we need to have a way, and that's where, like, we were kind of talking about making dogs stronger. What can we cue for a dog to let them know, hey, this is time to go or it's not time to go? It's those cues, It's those cues that let the dog know you need to go. I tell my law enforcement guys that are having problems with the dogs. Not, like, they show up to a track, and they're like, what are we doing? Just looking around, and everybody's like, "Sook," or telling them their command, right? Over. And the dog is like, ah, you can say it a million times, buddy, but I don't know what you're saying. Because they don't have a routine to tell the dog, this is what you're going to do next.
That's right. And it's not as fun for them to do that versus the others.
They just don't understand what's happening. They're just like, well, are we going for a walk? Like, what's happening here, right? Versus my dog. He's my dog. He's always around my house. But if you put the thick 2-inch leather collar on him and a tactical vest, he's a completely different animal. He just gets ready. And if I have the leash on the collar, he knows he's looking for explosives. But if I switch that leash from the collar and I hook it to his harness, instantly his nose is going to go to the ground and he knows I got to find a dude and bite him. I don't even have to say a command. I have it on video. I put him. Yep. He knows when that I have this vest on and this collar on and the leash goes from my collar to my vest. That only happens when I'm going to go find a dude to bite. Right.
And that's just through high repetition. Scenarios.
Every day since that dog was 8 weeks old and I started teaching him tracking, I put a little vest on him and the leash went from his collar into his little vest and we started doing training.
Yep.
And I did that since he was 8 weeks old, 10 weeks old. So now I don't have to say track. I don't have to say anything, just what I'm doing. Just like in law enforcement, the second they get out of the car and they start screaming, Marin County Sheriff's Office, canine, you better come on out or you're going to get dog bit.
Yeah.
The dogs are inside the patrol car going nuts because they know that only happens right before I go out. Right. So if we have a routine that is telling the dog, hey, you're about to go do X, the dog's going to be ready to do X. And not just that, we can take the behaviors that getting ready produce and use them in situations we don't know, right? Let me put it this way. I have some dogs that love to do bite work, and they put on the harness. And when they do bite work, they're the most confident they have ever been in their lives, right? Mm-hmm. So if I have the dog is struggling a little bit, when we take them into a Bearcat, the little SWAT car, right? The little SWAT vehicle that they do, that is an armored personnel carrier vehicle, right? A lot of dogs getting that like sausage tube with like six dudes that are completely kitted out with vests and rifles, and they get the dogs get a little not so sure about being in here. But put on a biting vest, and you're gonna see the dog get super confident because oh, we're gonna go do bite work. The thing that I love the most is happening. Sure. Yeah. So I'm being a part, you know, like taking over that behavior to use it somewhere else that I need it.
That's right.
So it's a way to help myself, you know.
Absolutely. So one of the questions that I had with all these things and with every person I've had in the protection sport world is I've done my job of creating those cues and maybe mm-hmm. I've done it too much because now A plus B equals C and D, I get the bird and they don't mm-hmm. wait for me to say it and they go. So if you've created, I clipped you from your collar to your vest. Now it's time to go bite a dude and a, mm-hmm. and he's tracking along and it's time to bite a dude, but there's a innocent bystander on the side. You still have to have that discipline and self-control to say, not that one, keep looking. You know, how Absolutely. Do we, like they use the word drive cap all the time and maybe even too yep. loosely, but mm-hmm. how do we continue to build confidence, continue to build drive, continue to build this beast of burden that we all want, yet in the heat of the moment, still a team player, still under control and fun versus crap.
Yeah. I think that comes from obedience being used as a stop, not a gas pedal. Right. And I think you touched on it very well, because if I'm tracking, right, and my dog is running a track and I see there's a person there, the first thing I'm going to do is down. I'm putting what we're calling a forward down. Wherever you are in the middle of the track, just down and slam into a down. And then I get to talk to that person. I get to call the person back. Or if I choose they're going to get bit, then I can send my dog. But that down doesn't tell the dog you made a mistake. Stop right. doing what you're doing. Does that make sense? It tells him, oh, you got to do this first. Then you get the fun. It's something right. you have to do for me first, right? And then you mentioned that drive capping. It's the most misunderstood, one of the most misunderstood terms on the industry, because people think drive capping equals squashing behaviors. And it is not. It's compartmentalizing, right? Making those, it's like a pressure cooker. You're not telling the dog, no, stop it. You're not going to do that. You're telling the dog, hold on. Hold on. Imagine a bunch of Vikings about to go loose, right? And you're like, wait, wait. And you're trying to keep all those Vikings from breaking the line.
Right.
And you're like, not yet. That's drive capping.
Okay.
You're not telling them, no, don't go. Don't be so excited. Everybody, calm down. Take a seat. Right? Yeah. You're not telling them that.
Well, what do you do about the Viking who takes off?
And that's where you have to have your tools, right?
Like right.
And you have to have, like, if I have, I know that one Viking breaks all the time, I'll probably put him on a chain.
Yeah.
So whenever he takes off, he's the end of the line. And I can tell him, not yet. You know right. what I mean?
Yeah.
But is that drive? Is that you want to go? So whenever my dogs hear a down, when they're in a track, it doesn't mean you made a mistake, come back. It means, oh, you're about to get it. Get ready, yeah. because after that down, you get to go. So I'm always teaching the dogs, be at the top of your drive, but listen, because there's control, right?
Yeah.
But so, as long as the control doesn't break the drive to work.
Yeah, that's exactly it, is the control can't break the drive to work.
No, the control is the key to work. The control is what gets you to do the work, right?
Now, one that's of the things- way,
discipline.
That's right. Discipline. Self, like not discipline being hard on them. Discipline being self-control.
Yes. Yeah. Self-control.
Agreed. Now, one of the things that we struggle with is, you know how it'll like leak? the drive a leak, right? And so maybe it comes from vocalization, or maybe in your world, it's taking a bite on the handler. You know, like
that's the most common.
Yeah, it's going to come out somewhere. Vocalizing for us, a dog that whines or barks, is a big no-no. Where if they're leaking drive by being vocal in the protection sport world, it really probably doesn't matter unless you are tier one special forces and the dog's got to be quiet and sneaky. I could
we
see
call them SWAT dogs. Yeah, we call them SWAT dogs, the ones that are super quiet.
Okay, yeah. I feel like that would be a good dog to have if you're trying to sneak up on somebody versus the dog that gets out and starts barking the whole time anticipating. Yes. So we've got to manipulate the situation with these dogs to build drive, ask them to do A, B, and C before they go and do the retrieve. So we're capping, right?
Yep.
But if it leaks out in a negative, like barking or whining, man, that just, I mean, it's literally one of the worst things a dog can do for us.
Okay. It's just barking when they're out there.
Yeah. Cause if you're
for us, we do too.
You don't like that either?
No, man. No, we don't. Because I'm saying probably for the same reason, because you're sitting there and the dog starts barking, everything.
Yeah. Sucks.
Yeah. Same for us. Like, for example, we have a liability issue in the law enforcement world. And it is that if you have a dog at the door, when the handler is shouting commands, that is barking, and the handler is like, so-and-so canine unit, come on out, you're going to get dog bit. The guy inside can say, I never heard nothing. There was a dog barking. That's all I heard.
Right.
So we have to make sure the dogs are quiet when we're working. And it all starts with outside of the exciting work, okay? Mm-hmm. Meaning, you cannot teach a dog to be quiet at a door when he knows he's going to go get a bite inside that house. It's too much. It's too high speed for him. He wants to get in there way too much, right? So you have to start with the whatever way you can replicate the behavior with the dog being at a lower state of mind, right? So try to find a way, like that's why we use food versus toys. Sometimes food takes a dog in a very, very slow pace of mind versus toys make them so wound up,
right?
Like food is slow and steady work because you flush if you go too fast and you don't get to hunt. So food is a good way to always go back to food, do a little bit of shaping, and you know, start working at a lower speed where the dog is at a lower drive level. But at the end of the day, we have something. You guys use the dominant dog collars at all? Is that the little paracord? No? Okay, so excuse me. So we use something that is called a dominant dog collar. Okay. And it is nothing other than a paracord that is custom made to fit, and it goes perfectly behind the dog's jawline. If it's right there. And it's so tight that you grab the little ring at the end and you pull on it and the dog just, they go quiet. They can do nothing, right? Hmm. So we use that a lot where we put the dog into the door or somewhere where the dog is at a lower speed. And we have a lot of what we call whiny shepherds, right? Like dogs that sit there like leaking.
Yeah.
So you grab that and you put a little leash on it and you literally pull on it and the dogs go quiet. They can't. They can't talk. They can do nothing. Now, of course, they also lose their breath. So you have to make sure that you control it. But you cannot teach a dog something unless you can produce the behavior somehow before. Does that make sense? Yeah. I need to produce the quiet before I can tell him, be quiet. If I cannot produce the quiet, I cannot condition nothing to it, right? So whenever the dogs have a way for me to make them be quiet, the second they're quiet, I can be yes and then send them.
Okay.
I can tell them, be quiet, and then send them. Mm-hmm.
Let's take that as an example and say, I got that going. I lift up on the lead, basically choke them.
Yep.
Now we come up the leash or we start spinning alligator roll. I mean, I know I've dealt with that.
You're probably trying it. No, absolutely. You're probably trying it at a too much of a like excitement level.
Like he's already too hot.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is something we talk about, thresholds, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say that you always train where you shoot your shotgun in the exact same spot in a little mound. You have shells all over it. That's how much you shoot in that one spot, right? The dog gets within 5 feet of that spot, he's probably going to go nuts because he knows that's where we train, right? Mm-hmm. But 15 feet before it, he's pretty excited. He notices it, but his brain is not gone yet.
right? That's where to teach
it. That's the work. Bingo. That's where you work.
Okay.
If you're too close, his brain is consumed by it. If you're too far, they don't notice it. They want to find the spot where they notice it, but you still have their attention a little bit. And then you slowly work your way up to that, you know, to the progress.
So like, as you're moving forward, you're going to, you know, deal with it and then back up.
Yep.
And then move closer again and just try and work all your way to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Bingo. Exactly. Yeah. And then that's something that you have to be, we call it chunking. You break it into chunks. And then if you mess up, you start at the beginning.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Same thing, different terminology, different breeds.
Exactly.
Dude, I would love to come and meet you in person. Is there anything, I know we're getting close to our time limit, if not actually a little above it, but is there anything you'd like to leave everybody with? Where can they find you on social media? I appreciate you. This was a really fun conversation.
Good, man. Same. We got to do it again. We got to do another one. I'll probably have you on my account and we can have another one because we can talk about so much more.
Oh, but, so much.
So one thing that I would like to leave everyone is that I'm more like in bird dog and law enforcement, you know, we still have the privilege of using tools, of training tools and the e-collar and stuff like that. Let's be the advocates, man, for doing it the right way.
Yeah.
Let it not be our fault, the reason that we lost the training tools here in this country. So to all of those of you out there that get to use an e-collar, that get to use, you know, the dominant dog collar I just talked about, all of those tools, man, let's do it the right way. Let's do it. Stop abusing dogs. Stop overdoing it the wrong way, because that's how we lose them. And it's not the ones doing it right. It's one person that's doing it wrong, right? So let's be the ambassadors for these training techniques and these training tools that we hold so dear. And why our training is still so good in these countries, because we have access to those tools. So let's try to be the best at it. And just remember, man, that if you get to work with a dog, you're in the top 1% of people in the world that gets to have the you know, such a lucky job or whatever that you get to go play with your dog and you get to go use them. So let's be happy about that and appreciate it, you know?
Absolutely. No, dude, thank you very much. That's a great point. Where can everybody find you on Instagram and Facebook and website?
Absolutely. It's all the same. Carlos Ramirez Canine. And that's the K and the number 9. Carlos Ramirez Canine. And that's in Facebook, Instagram. And the website is carlosramirezcanine.com. And we travel and we do law enforcement and private seminars all across the U.S., you know. So anyone that wants to reach out, that's a good place to get a hold of me.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much for spending your afternoon with us. It was really fun. Happy holidays to you and your family. And we'll definitely do it again. I appreciate it.
Perfect. I really appreciate you guys having me on.
Hey, join our community. If you enjoy the show, if you enjoy our YouTube, if you enjoy Instagram, it's like buying me and Kevin a beer. Join patreon.com/loneduckoutfitters. The link is in the description. Click that link. Join the community. We've got tons of great videos, tons of great content, and you can ask me more questions. So join it. Enjoy it. We did it for you, and you're helping us produce a show. So thank you so much to that community. Get in, get out, let's roll. patreon.com/loneduckoutfitters.
Hey listeners, Nick Larson here, host of the Bird Shop Podcast. As fans of this show, you may be interested in the conversations on the Bird Shop Podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting, from upland birds and their habitat and conservation to the shotguns, bird dogs, and gear used to pursue them. Whether you're a seasoned upland hunter or just getting started and wanting to learn more, I interview a wide range of guests, each with their own unique perspective and valuable experience to share. If you're on the hunt for more upland hunting conversation, please consider subscribing to the Bird Shop Podcast today. We'll